This meeting to order, and the purpose of tonight's meeting, if I can live through it here without coughing and dying. Maybe it was just too much timber, fourth practice act yesterday and other things today. What we're having tonight is the Yagataga oversight hearing, and the reason I became involved in this was some requests from public people and other people that were interested in what has been happening in that area over the years. So from my standpoint as a legislator and speaking to my colleagues, the idea is to get people at the table and lay the cards out and see where it's at, and informing us as legislators what direction we're going. So we'll go ahead and get started tonight, and we do have from DNR, we have Mr. Bob Dick, who is the state director of forestry. And Bob, would you like to come forward, please? And what I would like to do is break your testimony up in, like, maybe, I don't know how long you have, but when it's the time for questions, let us know. Okay. So we can go ahead and
could I bring Gary Gunterson with me?
Sure, thanks. That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Dick, State Forester and Supervisor, Division of Forestry. With me this evening is Greg Gustafson, the Division Director of Division of Land and Water Management. What we would like to do would be to have Gus give you a brief overview of the land and water responsibilities of KP Yagataga timber sales, and I would like to go into some of the history and background, then we can have questions.
Okay, then what I'd like to do is announce who is here. We have Senator Szymanski from the Senate side, and we have Representative Davis, Representative Gall, Representative Navarre, and Representative Foster will be joining us. He just ran upstairs, and there may be other resource members coming in. Go ahead, Mr. Dick, or Mr. Gustafson, who's ever going first.
Mr. Chairman, other members. Seems like I was just here about 2 hours ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was a long day from resources. We started with subsistence at 1:30, huh?
It has been. DNR is currently engaged in a process to decide whether carrying through with a 1985 court settlement is in the best interest of the state. And if the answer to that question should be yes, then how to best design the expansion of the timber sale to accommodate it. I'm going to describe for you briefly the playing field. It seems like whenever you get into a land use issue, you pretty much got to know the geography to figure out where you go from here. And a lot of people I see in this room have some personal first-hand experience of the geography that we're talking about, but for those that don't, I'd like to put it in perspective. Basically, we've got a number of issues here, actions, both real and proposed, that affect a chunk of real estate extending from roughly Icy Cape to Cape Suckling. It's an area rich in wildlife and fisheries. There are numerous anadromous fish streams that are on Fish and Game's catalog, other streams that may have salmon that aren't on the catalog. It's an area of marine mammals, waterfowl, moose, bear, mountain goats, and a good number of other critters. It's also an area where there have been, in the past, human activities. There are a number of mining claims up the White River along the beaches of Cape Yakutaga. Those are federal and state claims, by the way. It's an area where there's been past timber harvest. I see Cape 1 and I see Cape 2, and associated roads and a log transfer facility to get that timber out to market.
And you're on there, right, Gary?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Please continue.
It's also an area where a couple of years ago, the Department of Natural Resources conveyed limited timber rights to the University of Alaska under the authority of Title 29, the Municipal Entitlements Act, with widespread public notice, three public hearings, an ACMP, that's a coastal consistency determination, and that involved three parcels, effectively White River, Cape Suckling, and Yakutaga. Those parcels were the subject of a 1980 land use planning report. That planning report designated the White River and Cape Suckling areas for forestry, and at the time, the Yakutaga tract was unclassified. That's because at that time, it had not yet been conveyed to the state of Alaska. These conveyances were subject to a number of parameters and conditions, including adherence to the Forest Practices Act, whatever that may look like, at the time of the harvest. There was protection, elevation contour protection, above which trees couldn't be cut to ensure that goats were protected. There were significant buffers left, even in excess of the Forest Practices Act standards at the time, along certain anadromous streams. Other things that are going on in this chunk of real estate include various proposals for legislative areas. In the past, there have been proposals for a state forest involved much of this area. There's also been a proposal more recently for a state critical habitat area. Another thing that's been going on recently is the city of Yakutat's proposal for boundary extensions in terms of creating a
Excuse me, question?
I'm sorry, state critical habitat area, where is
that? State game refuge, I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative Gull.
Thank you, Mr. Justice.
Also, creating a coastal resource service area and coastal district for the city of Yakutat. We have recreational use of this area in many places for sport fishing and sport hunting. We've also got commercial fishing in many areas. There's also traditional values going on. And in the past, there's even been oil exploration activity that has occurred dating back to the 1950s. In response to the need to address the court settlement, the department has recently prepared two documents which have been the subject of public review and several public hearings held in Cordova, Yakutat, and Seward. These documents are entitled the proposed finding decision and ACMP, that's Alaska Coastal Management Program, consistency determination regarding modification of the Icy Cape 2 timber sale. That's a document prepared by the Division of Forestry. And the second document is prepared by my division, the Division of Land and Water Management. It's officially entitled the Site-Specific Land Use Plan, which is a requirement of state law for any disposal of state interests. And it involves land classifications for five areas of state-owned uplands and one area of state tide and submerged lands along the coast. The plan provides for specific guidelines and parameters for the management of these areas in the future, and it affects approximately 280,000 acres. By the way, there's almost a half million acres involved in this entire area that I've been talking about. Incidentally, this area is also outside any existing municipality or borough. It's another consideration at play here. So what we've got is a whole bunch of interwoven land use activities and proposals that need to be taken into account. It presents a heck of a challenge. It's certainly been an interesting process, and it's one that we've attempted to delve through and sort through as we engaged in this entire process. One more thing, specifically having to do with the land use plan. We've got various maps around the room that a number of people have brought. I think they're all collectively useful in some aspect to give folks a better handle on what's going on at this area and what it specifically looks like. There's also photographs of various areas. One thing I want to mention about the plan itself, there is a proposal or management intent for resource management for several areas that includes the Leeper Glacier area, the Bering Glacier, and other adjacent lands. The Ducktooth River area is also being proposed for classification as resource management. Cape Suckling itself is a smaller area. It's being proposed for classification as wildlife habitat. Cape Yakutega, a larger track, being proposed as a joint classification for forest land and wildlife habitat. And finally, the tidal and submerged areas from roughly Cape Suckling to Icy Bay, that's the area immediately adjacent to mean high water extending offshore, is being proposed for resource management, with one small area designated for at the log transfer, existing log transfer site being proposed for that activity. That, in a nutshell, is what the site-specific plan is based upon.
Senator Smansky has a question.
Gary, I probably not most people in the room understand when you say the word settlement. You picked up in your testimony from this thing called a settlement forward. I'm going to make sure for the record I understand what settlement we're talking about. We're talking about the Sullivan Group, Icy Cape 2 settlement.
Good if I'm on or not. That's correct. It's expansion of the Icy Cape 2 timber sale. And Bob's about to get into the way in which that settlement has come about.
Okay, but before we do that, I also want to make sure that we get things in proper perspective, because I think it's very important, and it's a very critical point to where we're at. The settlement occurred, and Bob will probably get into the description of the settlement area, about a year after the settlement ended, DNR included, then moved a portion of the settlement area to the University of Alaska, which was classified forestry area. Is that correct?
No, Senator, it's not exactly correct. The area that was proposed for expansion of the settlement was west of the White River. Obviously, there's a lot of land west of the White River. There was an area adjacent to the White River that was conveyed to the University of Alaska, yes.
Was that classified for timber at that time?
It was classified, as I mentioned earlier, it was classified for forestry, yes.
Forestry. And the reason I think that's very critical is, if that hadn't been done, would have there been any reason to assume that the Ice Cape 2 sale could not have been accomplished in its entirety? Or it couldn't have been harvested without what you're now going through to be the expanded reclassification?
That's a difficult one to, I'm not being evasive, that is a difficult question to answer, because that's a very large area with a lot of timber resources in it.
Well,
I'm not sure I can answer it.
Well, maybe Bob Dick could answer then. The area that you conveyed to the University of Alaska, to the north of that, to that area that you conveyed, if that forestry area had not been conveyed to the University of Alaska and it was still available to the Sullivan Group, would there be any necessity to go to reclassification today?
I can't answer the reclassification question. All I can answer is the if that had not been conveyed, there certainly is enough timber there.
Certainly is enough timber. So for the record then, you're saying that the timber area that was conveyed to the University of Alaska following the settlement would have satisfied the Ice Cape 2 sale without moving to a new classification?
I can answer the question up to the point of classification. I can't answer it beyond that.
Well, but you know, is there enough there to satisfy it?
There's enough timber there.
There's enough timber there. And I guess the significant point there is, obviously, that what you're now describing is moving, and what you've described, Greg, is a reclassification that is precipitated by the fact that there is not forestry classified area available to satisfy the Ice Cape 2 sale and settlement agreement.
Immediately west of the White River.
That's true.
Right.
And it's not there because it was given up to the University of Alaska following the settlement agreement. Is that true?
Well, it's sort of like the old 20/20 hindsight argument.
I don't want to put any blame on anybody. I just want to make sure that we've got it, that's proper. I don't want to have any unfactual positions.
If you're talking about areas that at the present, or before we began this process, were already classified for forestry immediately west of the White River, I think you're correct.
Okay. Because it's because now we're short in Icy Cape 2 and classified forestry land that you've moved to the reclassification process. That's correct. And that's where we're picking up on it now. Okay, thank you.
Can I add one thing to that?
Sure.
Chairman? Senator Zemanski. That isn't to deny that it isn't in any way appropriate to take a look at an area which had an old classification. In many cases, we had land that was transferred to the state since the land had been classified, so it was unclassified. We did have some unclassified areas that technically had trees on them and could have been made available. But because they've been recently conveyed to the state, they weren't available.
I agree, but I want to guess to where we're at. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as I stated before, I'm Bob Dick, Supervisor of the Division of Forestry, and what I would like to do at this point, because the situation is so complex, I'd like to lead us through a discussion of the issue of the timber sales, the lawsuits, and some of the other factors, the fiscal data, environmental data, not at length, that we will be dealing with tonight. I've done my best to present the facts to keep any editorializing out of it. The history is this. We have two timber sales. Icy Cape timber sale number one, which you see at the at the north part of Icy Bay. It was sold in 1969. It was a 20-year timber sale. It was closed in 1989. It was comprised of 200 million board feet. The last cutting occurred in 1987. The last real cutting occurred in 1984. The ensuing 3 years was pickup of blowdown salvage, etc. The second timber sale, Icy Cape.
And if I could tell you, in where are we on the map with that thing, roughly?
Icy Cape One timber sale started here, it began here, and it ended right here at Fall Creek.
It begins roughly at Icy Bay and runs west.
And how long of a distance are we talking there?
It's roughly about 18 miles lineal, like clockwise.
And what was the volume?
It was 200 million board feet.
Do you have photographs of that? Is that any of these photographs of the area that you're working?
We have photographs of some of the areas, but that is the photograph. That is aerial photography you're looking at right there.
I mean photographs of what the activity up there looks like?
Sure. We have a photograph right here that I'd like to show later. Would you like me to show it now?
No, go ahead.
Okay, Icy Cape number 2 is directly to the west of Icy Cape number 1. Icy Cape number 2 was sold in 1983. It was a 5-year sale, which remains open and has been extended. Icy Cape number 2 had approximately 50 million board feet in the sale.
How many?
Both timber sales resulted in lawsuits. In 1985, the owners of both timber sales sued the state. In Icy Cape number 1, the question of the suit was a volume underrun. The owner of the timber sale claimed that there were not enough trees there. In Icy Cape number 2, the owner of the sale claimed that the stumpage calculation was too great. He was losing money on the sale. For legal reasons, both of these lawsuits were merged. In 1986, the state settled both lawsuits. Actually, Icy Cape number 1 was settled between the two contractors. Icy Cape number 2 was settled by the state adding additional volume to the timber sale. Between 16 and 20 million board feet. It's important to remember, we'll talk about this more later, that we solved in Icy Cape number 2 a value problem with more trees. The additional volume, as per the settlement agreement, was to come from west of the White River. It is important to understand the mechanics of the settlement itself. The settlement was constructed, reviewed, and approved by former Governor Sheffield and his AG. The settlement was approved by a court, and at that time, it came to DNR for implementation. I would like to add that the owner of Icy Cape sale number 2 operated the sale for 1 year between 1984 and 1985. He went bankrupt in 1985. The sale came back to the Department of Natural Resources, and in 1988, in the ensuing 3 years, nothing happened on the sale. The sale was sold to Chugach Alaska Corporation, who presently owns the timber sale. Let me go back and go through some data. Icy Cape number 1 returned $5.2 million to the state. There were no real problems with the fiscal management on Icy Cape number 2. I'm sorry, Icy Cape number 1. Icy Cape number 2 is a different story. To date, the stumpage return to the state is approximately $728,000. As a result of the first owner of Icy Cape number 2 going bankrupt and Chugach Alaska buying the timber sale, and as a part of the settlement agreement constructed by former Governor Sheffield and his crew, there was an outstanding amount of money of $780,000 owed to the state. As per the settlement agreement, this is the settlement that was constructed by the former governor and the AG, there has been a total of $85,000 cash paid to the state. there has been approximately $290,000 worth of work done as a result of the settlement. The settlement stipulated that a number of things be done to fulfill the settlement outside of the contract. That added up to $780,000. To date, approximately $375,000 of that $780,000 has been either paid for or the work has been accomplished. That leaves about $400,000 owing as a result of the settlement. I want to make it very clear that the present owner of the timber sale is not in arrears in his stumpage payments. The present owner still owes the state some money, but it is a result of the settlement, not stumpage. I'd like to talk about some environmental data. Icy Cape number one was broken into units by low value timber, etc. There were no buffers that were purposely left. There were a few tried. The Department of Fish and Game and DNR did try some buffers, they blew down. There were some seed blocks left in the area, and there were also some stands left that adequately regenerated the area.
How wide were the buffers?
I have no idea.
That blew down.
Obviously, I don't know how wide they were. Mike?
We tried various lengths of buffers from 400 feet to just 50 feet or so, and we had various success.
Thank you.
My guess, Representative Navarre, is that the buffers were probably more poorly placed than the question of width. The regeneration in Icy Cape number one is excellent to too good. The pictures I have here are of Icy Cape number one. You can come look at them. Each one of these pictures represents a site that has been checked, and each site has been found to be at least fully stocked to our standards. It's hard to tell in some of these areas, particularly in this picture here where you see a lot of alder. The trees are there. And this is important because I have seen some aerial photography of the areas that do not show the young seedlings. It is important to recognize that to determine whether or not an area is stocked, that you have to actually walk through the areas and take plots and count the seedlings. Icy Cape number two has 8 units that average 90 acres per unit. I think it's important to note here that there were 17 plus miles of leaf strips. Of that 17 miles, a quarter mile had failed, in our opinion. There is also one buffer strip where a logger encroached in a buffer zone, and we lost 40 to 50% of that particular buffer zone. I want to emphasize that particular buffer zone was left as wildlife habitat or wildlife corridor. Fish were not affected by the logger encroaching on the leaf. The regeneration in Icy Cape number two has not been formally checked. It will be as the units reach the age for checking, but visual checking has confirmed that the units are generally overstocked. Too many trees rather than not enough. Another issue I'd like to discuss is the issue of agency relationships. It is no secret, after hearing some of the reports on the radio, that this has been billed as the shootout at the OK Corral, and that the Department of Fish and Game and the Division of Forestry particularly have not gotten along very well. A little history, and I think that's a fair statement. In Icy Cape number one, things started out okay, but we got heated up over goats. As a result of that, in 1979, Icy Cape number one was reduced by 50% in size for goat habitat. In Icy Cape number one, there was typically not as much fish and game presence as there has been in recent years in Icy Cape number two. Moving to Icy Cape number two, we began to have a relationship with the fish and wildlife fish and game people in about 1987. There were a series of encounters culminating in late 1989 with an increasing flurry of what I call snotty grams between the two departments. And I'm not throwing rocks at anybody. I think we equally deserve responsibility. But I think the important thing to me is that we met today, Frank Rue, myself, his staff and mine, And while I don't want to be a Pollyanna and say peace is at hand, I think we are developing the processes to say we're getting there. We have solved things like goats, phased review, fish protection, etc. for the extension of Icy Cape number 2. That doesn't mean we can go back and undo some of the things that have been done, some of the things that have been said in the past, but I want to emphasize, I think we're getting there. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about inventory and cruising.
Okay, Mr. Dick, yeah. I would like you to, will you be able to sum it up in about 5 minutes?
You bet.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. There's been a question about inventory and cruise data. There is a difference. Inventory is the process of estimating how many trees, how much volume is on the ground over a large area. Cruising is the process of going in and measuring specific data for a timber sale. In both Icy Cape number 1 and number 2, we feel that the cruise data has been good. In the case of Icy Cape number 2, it came in within 6%. The cut came in within 6% of the estimate. That's very good. Inventory was first completed in 1975. That is at a what we call a confidence level of plus or minus 20%, 95% of the time. That means if you go out and check any particular place, that 95% of the time you're going to be within 20% of the volume. That's good. The inventory is being upgraded and analyzed. I want to emphasize that it is an arcane science. It is constantly changing. It's sort of like estimating fish returns. I want to talk a minute about the annual cut, which is based on the inventory. We have cut an average of 13 million board feet a year, which we feel is very conservative, about 50% of the theoretical annual harvest. As we revise the inventory, it could go down. The annual cut could go down from wildlife habitat removals, leave buffer strips, operability, etc. It could go up. There are areas that are coming into the merchantable timber pool from glaciers receding. I'm told this is substantial. It might stay the same. We don't know. Let me spend just a minute on enforcement. Icy Cape number 1 was generally seen not having that many problems. Icy Cape number 2, we had problems. We had distinct contract compliance problems with the original contractor in Icy Cape number 2. As I said earlier, he went out of business. Chugach Alaska has since purchased the sale, and I think everybody agrees that Chugach Alaska has more than done good. We've looked at a number of alternatives for the Icy Cape number 2 extension, which finishes the settlement that I talked about earlier. We looked at the alternative of do nothing, let Chugach Alaska sue us. We felt that we were obligated to live up to the settlement even though we were not the perpetrators of that. So we find do nothing unacceptable. It was suggested that we look at the Icy Cape 2 leave strips, the buffer strips. The timber probably was there. We talked with Fish and Game. They asked us to say no. We said no. We looked at other trees, other parts of the state. We run into the problem that everybody else does that's not in my backyard. We looked at buying out Chugach Alaska, big bucks, about $1 million. We looked at the bug kill timber in other parts of the state. That has neither the volume nor the grade that we're looking for. In summary, we find this a terribly complex issue. We've looked for easy solutions. There are none. We've looked for less than easy solutions. We've found precious few of those. In finishing, I'd like to say we've done our best to live up to the settlement that was agreed to prior to our coming here. We're struggling, but we're trying. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from committee members? Then thank you. Don't run away, though. After we run through our list, we'll have opportunities to cross-examine. Right?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll be here.
Okay. I think as far as the agenda that we have Department of Fish and Game next. It has three people in there, and then we have interest groups, a number of interest groups. Right? Keeping track of the time as much as we can so no one group or one side gets more time than the other, and not everyone gobbles up all the time in the front end or on the other side. So with that, I would like to have Mr. Rue and Mr. Hardy and Mr. I think it's Grease. You don't all have to come up. We'll let you come up one at a time. But if you could do your testimony within 5 to 7 minutes, is that possible, or are we not in that arena?
Mr. Chairman, I think I could do it.
But if it doesn't seem fair, you know, I mean, let me know.
We'll be here, Mr. Chairman. You can answer, ask questions. Why don't Dave and Herman, if you don't mind?
Sure, fine.
Because I think some of the questions might be of them.
However the flow is, that we get the prospectus, the whole meeting.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Crew. I'm director of the Habitat Division. With me here is Herman Grisez with the Wildlife Conservation Division from Cordova. He is our goat expert. He can tell you if you've got questions about goats and the impacts on goats, their use of the area. He's the most knowledgeable person. Dave Hardy on my right is a habitat biologist with the Division of Habitat in Sitka. He's been on the ground working with Department of Natural Resources on basic Cape 2 sail layout questions, and he would be a good person to ask questions about specific on-the-ground concerns, events, that kind of thing. Rick Reed is also in the audience here. He's the regional supervisor for the Habitat Division. He's had a long history with this issue and can answer other questions. We also have some mapped information on goat winter range and then the cutting units on the back. I wasn't sure what the interest of the committee was when I was putting together my notes, so I'll try and keep my remarks fairly brief here.
Now, Mr. What I'm saying is all three of you have about 25 minutes.
Great.
Is that?
That's plenty.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
25 minutes is more than adequate, I think.
Okay.
So I wasn't sure of your intent, but I think with the people I brought with me tonight, we can answer your questions. As Bob Dick of the Division of Forestry said, there's been a long and difficult history in this area. We've seen a lot of problems, and I think I'd like to touch on them, on some of them. But in touching on them, I hope that we can find ways to learn from past events, mistakes, and do things better in the future. I think there are things the administration can do better. And I think that, and we intend to do that, and I think there are things that the legislature can do to help. First, some of the problems. I think most of us, as Bob Dick said, we've inherited a bad situation, and we're doing our best to make the best of it. I'm a planner by training and by philosophy. I like to look at things holistically, try and sort issues out in that kind of a manner. I think what we're seeing here is a failure to look at that broad balancing act. We've seen cutting and associated human activities that we think are, you know, the likely causes of significant declines in goat populations. And we've seen as we've moved across the area, we've seen improvements in the way the layout of cutting has occurred. If you compare IC Cape 2 to IC Cape 1, there are dramatic improvements in the amount of retention for fish and wildlife resources. And I think in the extension, we've also seen improvements in how the sail has been laid out in the protections for fish and wildlife. We have seen in the past some problems with execution of the sail, particularly with the former contract in IC Cape 2. We're trying to, as Bob said, we're trying to resolve our major issues. I'm optimistic that we can fix problems with that we've had with the IC Cape 2 extension, and also with the coordination between the departments, which has been an important concern we've had. But I think there is one problem that we all need to think about some more and work on, and that is, as I was mentioning earlier, this idea of a comprehensive look. We've seen incremental decisions, and we're sort of stuck with incremental decisions made just looking at a small part of the universe. And I think that we need to expand our horizon in the future and take a look at all of the uses that are going on in this area. It's a complex area. Mr. Gustafson listed a bunch of the things that are going on, oil and gas, a lot of fish and wildlife resources, recreational uses. There is going to be cutting perhaps on the university timber. This area, I think, deserves a comprehensive look in the future to decide how these many uses are going to be made to work together. I think that the other thing that we can do is look through the Forest Practices Act as a way of making some important improvements in enforcement capabilities, not necessarily for this area, but I think this is, having seen some of the problems here, I think the planning provisions that are in the new proposed Forest Practices Act, some of the enforcement strategies that DNR would be able to employ, would help them avoid these kinds of problems elsewhere in the future. So I think there are things the legislature can do to help with helping avoid these kinds of problems in the future. I guess, given that main emphasis, I guess I'd like to make is that I think we need to look at this holistically in the future. And I guess with that, I'll open it up to questions and let Dave and Herman answer any questions you might have about the specifics.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roof. Senator Szymanski.
Thank you. As of today, have you been able to determine whether or not the area that's been proposed for reclassification from unclassified to forest is the words forestry?
It's a new classification.
Forest land. Can be accomplished to meet Fish and Game's concerns and still meet the extended Icy Cape 2 sales area, 16 to 20 million board feet obligation by the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Szymanski, as of today, I think we're getting real close to resolving all our concerns. We're pretty pleased with the way the layout has been done. I think what people, one of our main outstanding concerns was this idea of coordination. We want to make sure that as they move ahead with decisions in the area, that we're involved in those decisions. I think there's a commitment by the Department of Natural Resources to do a better job of involving us in some of the site-specific decisions. So, yeah, I think we're working on the language, but at this point, certainly with the layout concerns, the buffers, we're basically pleased with that. I think one thing people need to recognize is that in any of these decisions, what you're doing is a trade-off, a balancing. There will be effects on fish and wildlife, even with the protections that DNR is willing to provide. And what we've done is we've minimized those effects. And I think we've done a much better job than was done in Icy Cape 1 or even 2.
Would it be good too far to say that you have, you believe that there's ability to meet the extended needs then or not? I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's what I want to find out, whether or not you believe you're going to be able to meet the Icy Cape 2 extension area needs, 16, 20 million board feet, or not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe, given what we've talked about today, yes, that we can do that.
Let me ask you a second follow-up question associated with that, because that's dealing with the immediate problem associated with one timber sale. But as you said, there's been problems from one end of the area moving toward the other, in some form or another, from your perspective. Do you see, how would we best get a handle on the entire area from Fish and Game's perspective in assessing what, I guess you'd say, the highest and best use from the public's perspective would be of that area in the future? How do we get down the road from here then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think there's probably the most obvious option would be to do what DNR calls an area plan for that area, which is a broad regional plan, encompasses all the lands, all the uses. It's more rigorous information gathering on all uses. That would be one way to resolve some of the potential conflicting uses in the area.
And the reason that was not done, the age-old problem of funding, is that, or it was never requested, or what?
Mr. Chairman, I actually probably ought to put the question to Mr. Gustafson.
Okay.
But your solution would be at least an area plan.
That would be one solution.
Is there any other solution?
Well, I think the Department of Fish and Game, you've seen proposals on the table that would also resolve it, I think. There's various legislative proposals that might resolve the issue as well.
And what would that be?
Well, there have been proposals for a refuge and a state forest. At this point, those issues have not been resolved. In terms of administrative position, there's not an administrative position on those proposals, but those might work.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, do Dave and Herman, do you have specific presentations you want, or were you just going to answer questions?
We're here to answer questions.
Answer questions, okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gall.
I have a question. I'd like to hear each of your detailed analyses of the history of what's going on with habitat in that area over the last 10 years and what you expect in the future. And I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't use bureaucratic generalities. I'd like to know what's going on the ground. I'd like to have all the habitat issues on the table so that people know what we're talking about here. I haven't heard anything in the last hour that's given people specific understanding of what the conflict in this area are. I understand that we can generalize and say it's been bad, now it's getting better. I'd like to know what it is exactly that we're talking about.
You want to have a first, Dave?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gall, thank you for the opportunity to be here. It's kind of a long question, I think.
Dave, for the record, will you state your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Dave Hardy. I'm the area habitat biologist from SIPCA.
You have about 20 minutes. I understand the chairman's directions correctly.
I'll stretch at 5. We were 8:05. In between the two of them. If we can go to 8:10, I'll relinquish 5 minutes, and then we want to have the other groups, and then we want to be able to answer questions all the way around before we end here tonight.
Since I've been assigned responsibility for this area beginning in 1987, my knowledge of past acts is based on a review of the literature and discussions with the DNR, Fish and Game people who handled it. Beginning with the Ice Escape 2 sale, which occurred in 1970.
And Dave, could you talk a little bit louder and maybe just a little bit louder would help, because there are people on teleconference that want to hear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Beginning with the Ice Escape 2 sale, the department negotiated a number of residual habitat areas, leaf strips. We negotiated a 400-foot buffer area along the coast. We negotiated leaf strips along a number of streams. We negotiated a 400-foot upper elevation limit for harvest in order to minimize effects on goat habitat. We negotiated with DNR specific things like where the road right-of-way would be, where some of the gravel pits would be, and so on. They were hard-fought battles and they were compromises, but we negotiated a number of habitat matters that were substantially better than Icy Cape 1. I would say that one of the main sources of discord between us and the Department of Natural Resources has been what has happened to those leaf strips over time. For a variety of reasons, some of them were perhaps not designed as well as they should have been. There was some blowdown that has been harvest in leaf strips. A number of the leaf strips are gone. We had negotiated a 400-foot strip along the coast was supposed to be a timbered strip. In some places, the layout was not such that a 400-foot timbered strip was left. In some places, the operator logged beyond the boundaries of the units that were laid out and harvested 16 plus acres of leaf strip. There have been a number of problems in Icy Cape 2 in maintaining the habitat protection measures that we were pleased to have negotiated. I would say that a major source of contention between the department and the Division of Forestry has been our involvement in DNR decisions, implementation decisions on the ground. What we would like or what we would have, what we asked for frequently was an opportunity to participate with DNR in the evaluation of modifications to the timber set. Things like activities affecting leaf areas, new gravel pits, expansion of units, and so on. We have, in many cases, not been afforded an opportunity to participate in the identification and evaluation of alternatives. We have had problems with having to react after the fact. I would say probably the third principal source of discord between the agencies has been our concern over what appears to us to be a failure to adhere to public and agency processes like the Alaska Coastal Management Program, which require coordination with the publics and with agencies prior to making or changing decisions. We have also had a continued concern over goat habitat, and although we had negotiated some 400-foot upper elevation limit, there has been some harvest above that, and we sent probably a year arguing against a proposal to log an additional a part of Unit 11, which was also above that area. I think that's sort of the main focus of our frustrations. We have had a number of meetings and interchange of memos. I would say that the meeting we had today with Mr. Dick was probably the most successful one that we've had in several years. And he has assured us that the Department of Natural Resources has made a commitment to perhaps pursuing a way of handling the timber sale operations that will better balance our needs and make for a more effective and efficient administration.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Herman Grisey. I'm with Wildlife Conservation Division in Cordova. My management authority goes from Icy Bay on the east to Cape Fairfield, just east of Seward on the west. The history of Wildlife Conservation Division's concern in the Icy Bay area stemmed from initially from a survey of mountain goat populations in the Icy Bay area in 1977. Right. During that survey time, it was noticed by the observer that within the range of the hillside adjacent to the timber cell, the density of goats were much less than the adjoining areas. At that time, there was concern expressed to the Habitat Division, and at that time, work was begun to identify goat winter range on the ground, and it was from that beginning that the initial 400-foot elevation was negotiated. That 400-foot elevation was negotiated because the formation of land in that area caused the goats to winter down to that level at the beginning of that bench area. As they move farther down the coast, of course, that bench doesn't persist at that elevation in all cases. As the Icy Cape 2 cell went into effect, or prior to it going into effect, the crews went in again and identified goat winter range and tried to prevent some of the more important areas from being cut. One of those areas is between Pole and Lawrence Creek, which is called the 2-mile buffer between the cells. In that area, the goat winter range was found at fairly low elevation. It was assumed that the goats were moving to the beach in extreme snow winters. The difficulty with goats, as in deer, and deep snow winters, they have to have something catching the snow to allow them to move around. And of course, mature timber provides that catching mechanism to provide access to and from feeding areas. 1984, another survey was conducted. I might back up and mention that the survey in 1977 found roughly 400 goats between White River and Icy Bay, and the adjacent Brower Ridge area, there were 50 goats roughly identified. In 1984, another survey was conducted in the area between White River and Icy Bay. The survey resulted in 200 goats being observed in that area, and between well, in the Brower Ridge area between Cape Yakutag and White River, the survey resulted in roughly 35 goats being observed. Most recently, in this past August, another survey of the same area under as like conditions as possible, the survey results for those same areas between Icy Bay and White River produced slightly less than 100 goats. And in the Brower Ridge area between White River and Cape Yakutaga, 80 goats were observed. As between Icy Cape 2, the beginning of Icy Cape 2 and to present, there have been four separate events to to my knowledge, while just being on the ground, trying to identify Goat Winter Range. And in all cases, it was an effort that was based on finding pellet groups here at as low as possible on the hillside during the spring. And the problem with that is that many of these years that work was done were in mild snow winters, and when you don't have the deep snow to force goats down, you're not going to find the lower extreme of their winter range, and that's part of the problem we're facing. I guess our concern is that we may not be taking all the measures necessary to protect those extremes. And when we look at the population declines east of White River, it's very difficult to say exactly what mechanism is causing that decline. There are a lot of things that we're looking at. If you look at the weather conditions, we're assuming they're the same on both sides of the White River. The access over the period of time from 70s up to present, both areas have a very substantial airstrip. Access along the beach is provided in Super Cub. So access has always been a nemesis for goat populations anywhere where there's logging activities. And there's no question that we feel that access to the goat winter range, as well as during the summer periods and fall when the goats are being hunted, has caused some problems. Another interesting point to consider is that wolf populations became apparent in the 70s and have increased substantially in the area east of Cape Suckling, and have obviously impacted goats in those areas. But our feelings are that they've impacted both sides of the White River equally. Of course, that leaves not much else to consider except that the logging areas do show up quite a difference as far as what is left of the remaining habitat in that side, on the east side of the White River. The west side of the White River hasn't been impacted as of yet. I guess our feelings are that allowing cuts on that side, the west side of the White River, are going to impact goats. Whether or not we can retain a viable goat population, and when I speak of viable, I talk about a huntable population of goats. I can't answer that. We're making recommendations to DNR as far as what we think might prevent goats from leaving those winter ranges or being impacted. But until we do that and look at it a few years, we won't know if that was conservative or not. To be safe, I don't think that have a cut and expect to have the goat populations remain the same.
Representative Gall.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I want to keep within the time period that you stated there and be done by 5 after. I just have two quick questions. It's correct that the goats have declined 70% in Icy Cape 1 and 2, and they're still healthy in the non-cut area adjacent?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And is it correct that the movement of the harvest into the goat habitat occurred after the settlement that was described earlier, that part of the settlement included giving trees that were in that goat habitat?
Part of the settlement area is into an area that has not been impacted as of yet.
So you mean in the initial settlement with Sullivan regarding his overdue payments, there was no entry into goat habitat?
The areas that have been laid out are adjacent to Goat Winter Range.
Dave, do you want to respond on that?
Mr. Chairman, the operations under Sullivan did log areas that were at 400 feet, in some cases above 400 feet, but for the most part we're not in areas that we have specifically identified as wintering covering.
I see.
The settlement is for a new area.
And that area is or is not in goat habitat?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gall, the layout is adjacent to and probably abuts goat winter range in some of those areas, the way they're laid out at this time.
I see. But you don't see that as a problem, or you do?
Representative Gall, the problem is that we have no way of knowing how far away from goat winter range you have to be to not affect them.
I see.
And have you had an opportunity to assess public opinion in the area? Yakutat, Cordova, people who use the area from other areas in the state? Mr. Ruth?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gall. Why don't I just open up that up to Dave and Herman, since I don't live in Cordova and Yakutat. They may know better what the opinion is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gall, the opinion from the people that I can come in contact with, and most of these are hunters, being in Wildlife Conservation Division, and people that fly up and down the coast locally, their impression is that they want to know where the goats went. It's pretty clear that the population is declining dramatically.
And when you've attended or heard about public meetings in Yakutat or Cordova, not getting into the issue of whether or not they've been at public meetings, but where they have occurred, do you have what you think is a responsible sense of public opinion in those areas regarding the management of this area?
As far as the actions by DNR, my impression is that in Cordova there doesn't seem to be a lot of awareness of what's been going on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll have questions for DNR later.
Thank you.
I would like to note for the record that Representative Copeland is here, and he's been here for a long time, about 40 minutes.
Yeah, so you get on to the record, Neil.
I don't want to be on the record.
Senator Smassey.
Following up on Representative Ball's question, which is intriguing because habitat's habitat, and obviously if nobody had ever walked out there, including hunters or anybody else, the most purest way to maintain the environment out there would be to have no hunting, no mankind to walk out there, is that correct?
Senator Smassey, the purest way to maintain it is don't do anything.
Don't do anything with it. So, next thing that you have to ask yourself is, anytime you disturb it, in this case, in Icy Cape 1 and 2, you saw forestry operations going on. Will that, if nothing else is effective, wipe out, or is the goat population going to stay roughly the way it is? Is there going to be reforestation, regeneration over the next 100 years, or 50 years, or 75 years? And it, what was testified to by the Division of Forestry is that nature is going to come back and start doing its thing again. Do we know that, what's going to happen out there in the future if we don't do something to change it? If we do nothing?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm talking about the affected area right now, not the proposed area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Szymanski, my impression, and I think the impression of my colleagues, is that the areas that have been clear cut have a very short period of benefit to any ungulate. Once the trees have grown to a certain age, it reverts back to being essentially useless because there's nothing within that stand of timber to provide any food. So if the mechanism for the decline in the populations was a loss of winter range, then I don't see that the population is going to recover to previous levels. Now, another factor to consider is that the predator population is going to affect it regardless. But the potential for it to recover to the maximum of its potential with the presence of predators is not going to be there because the range is no longer in existence. And it will be that way for as long as it takes for that timber to open up again, which, depending on which expert you want to rely on, 120, 150 years perhaps, the earliest.
So I guess I was curious.
Go ahead, Representative Gall, and then Representative Copeland.
Thank you. I don't have a further question, but I guess I need to clarify my own feelings on this matter and avoid any further confusion, if that's what it is. The Constitution mandates that the state manage its resources for maximum use consistent with the public interest. And I don't think there's anybody who will be speaking today, I'm very interested in hearing what they have to say, who is seeking to alter that mandate. But maximum use doesn't mean a single use, it means multiple use. And it means providing for the needs of the area's people and the other residents of the state who use that area. And I have to agree with the comments that were made by witnesses earlier that a comprehensive area-wide approach to planning is necessary that truly responds to that diversity. And I think it's the opinion of many people that that
lack of diversity in the planning process is the problem here, not some example of how that manifests itself. I mean, so an area that had goats doesn't have goats today. That's unfortunate. But what are we going to do now? I think it's the question, and I would hope that possibly the testimony that we hear today would lead us to some common ground as to a management style which truly accommodates the diverse needs of area people and the people of the state. And so, although I know you weren't implying that I was suggesting that it would somehow be better to lock up the area, I think it's important to point out that the people who are pressing for a game refuge, the people who are pressing for state forests, the people who are seeking a change in management, generally have expressed, at least to me, that they're doing so because they feel that only a limited set of concerns have been addressed in the management of this area, and that those concerns have to be broadened. And you know, that's my purpose, just for the record.
One question, Senator.
I guess
I want to get one in there somewhere.
Okay, you're good. I'm not too sure I understand whether or not I initiated your response here, but going back to what I'm trying to figure out, are we at a critical stage where Fish and Game should make a management decision to stop hunting in that area today, as an example? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, I don't know whether or not your count at 40-some this year says that we're at the point which there's no more harvesting that should take place. I mean, we went from 200 down to 40, and is there going to be none next year, or what's happening? The boll weevil?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Szymanski, the history of the harvest in that area, we were fairly liberal, obviously, allowing the history of that area. At one time, we allowed the harvest of two goats. It's been reduced to one. Since about 1983, the season has stood as is, one goat for a period of essentially August through the end of January. And 2 years ago, that was reduced to September to the end of November. And now, the harvestable level in the area between White River and Icy Bay, based on the population level, based on the fact that it is declining, is two goats. And the process that we've used throughout Unit 6, which is Icy Bay through Prince William Sound, has been to close the area with emergency closure when the harvest has been reached, that upper maximum harvest level has been reached. The last 2 years, there have been no goats reported harvested in that area. However, the Brower Ridge area, which has a allowable harvest of three goats, had one goat this year, zero goats the year before. Now, had the harvest reached those levels, we would have closed it. If our process is, as the population declines, each year we expect the population to be a little bit less, unless a survey result proves otherwise, so that number will be reduced. Next year, it's likely that we will not open the season between White River and Icy Bay simply because of that concern.
Somebody's not reporting, or else there's some concerned hunters are not getting any.
Well, we do have indicated hunter use of the area. Success has been low.
Representative Copeland.
Yep, I just wondered.
Would you use the microphone for
you know, how much historical data you have over the long haul for the population of the both of the goats and the various predators. In Doll Ridge, are there sheep around there?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The populations have been monitored only by survey data since 1977 as far as goats go. The predator population, to answer your question, there are no sheep. This is a coastal zone, and
I
the snow levels
are
not
all.
They didn't allow the sheep to move into the area. The predator populations are difficult to assess. They don't stand still. They don't stand out in the open, allowing you to count. The reliability of those counts are very inaccurate, unless you have the right conditions and the right amount of time spent in the air. But the one thing we do know is that wolves were essentially absent during the 60s, and during the 70s they did appear. And they did increase substantially, and right now we, in the area between Cape Suckling and Icy Bay, our estimate is that there's between 30 and 40 wolves. The bear population may range from Cape Suckling to Icy Bay between 100 and 150 brown bear, and maybe twice that many, three times that many black bear.
thank you very much. I'll ask the last question, and then we'll move on to the Mayor Powell. In these areas, I guess I have a series of three questions. And number one, do you feel that your management resource, as far as funding and staffing, is adequate to manage the area responsibly? Number two, has there been any disease reported in the area as far as the goat side? And have we looked at managing the wolf population as far as in those areas? And all that in about 2 minutes, I guess.
I'll answer the first one. No.
No.
We don't think so. And actually, Mr. Chairman, I think that's another thing about the Forest Practices Act. If there's a fiscal note attached to it, we, at least in the Habitat Division, could be on the ground more, better able to help manage these areas. So that's, and then the other two questions were for Mr. Grisey.
As far as the wolf populations and controlling the wolf population, there was a proposal that was dealt with by the Board of Game in November. At that time, the proposal was to allow land and shoot, which is a method of taking wolves, and that was turned down, was not accepted by the board. The board has also tasked the Department of Fish and Game to be involved in a wolf management planning process that may in time identify this area as an area for wolf control. Having not gone through the planning process, it's difficult to say what's going to happen there.
Dave, did you have a response?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then thank you very much. Don't leave. We'll get you back on cross-examination here. I think Mayor, it's time for you. We have Mr. Larry Powell. He's the mayor of Yakutat. I regret, Mr. Mayor, that I didn't get you up in front. I don't read my own notes from my staff, so I knew Mr. Dahl would get his time here, but I didn't want him.
Anytime I have, I'll be able to come here. No apologies necessary. And Mr. Chairman, members, I appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk with you this evening. Just a little, maybe personal history. I've been in Yakutat for probably 25 years.
Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record again?
I'm sorry. My name's Larry Powell. I'm the mayor of the city of Yakutat. I have been for probably 20 years. And so I've been through this whole process since the Icy Bay, Icy Cape logging process began back in the early 70s or so. Length of, you know, our involvement, as I said, goes back in, you know, to when this began, and it actually was a carryover from when the department, the division, was logging in Yakutat proper. And I suppose many of you that maybe have landed at Yakutat have noticed the large numbers of clear cuts that are on the immediate adjacent environs of the city proper. A lot of those were state cuts due to the selections that were performed back in the late 50s, early 60s by the state. Quite frankly, I guess I'm a bit embarrassed to be here tonight and tell you that I've been involved with this and been mayor for the past 18 years and have actually been able to accomplish so little in trying to get something done up in this Icy Bay, Icy Cape area in a more positive manner. We tried. I've probably written most all of the letters that have ever come out of the city of Yakutat trying to address this problem, both to the department as well as to, you know, former governors. And of course, this whole problem, as you well know, spans four governors, numerous commissioners, but the bureaucracy that's in place has remained. It's still, you know, kind of the same people, once you strip away the governor and the commissioners, that pass back and forth. We sat back after realizing that the state was going to begin a harvesting program in the Icy Bay area, knowing what the past actions we had personally witnessed in the community itself, and we had a lot of problems: blowdown, creeks that were productive creeks that were impacted as a result of
harvesting actions, both windfall as well as what we believe water quality problems. So we just, I guess, began the process by waiting, wait and see what happens up there, and that probably went on for a period of probably 4 or 5 years, and we gradually began to get these reports coming in from fishermen and people flying over the area as to what exactly was happening, and starting to hear some, you know, really alarming reports that harvesting was being conducted in a manner that was not consistent with, you know, multiple use of practices. It was not giving due deference to habitats, for particularly for fisheries, which Yakutat, that's our number one industry, and a good portion of our annual income, residence income, comes from this area, from Icy Bay in that area and west, all the way to Cape Suckling. All the way to Cape Suckling, by the way, is the commercial fishing area for Yakutat set net fishermen. A big part of the problem that existed up there in regards to the controversy and the conflict with fisheries certainly revolved around the question of surveying and cataloging anadromous streams prior to any time when harvesting or planning should take place. And that didn't happen. It didn't happen for some of the reasons that you heard these gentlemen from Fish and Game earlier attest to, which is a lack of manpower, a lack of notification, a lack of any funding coming from anywhere in which to get in and do these things that are necessary prior to a harvesting plan and actually getting on the ground and starting to harvest. Doing those things ahead of time, if you don't do it ahead of time, then we witnessed the process whereby DNR officials were trying to go in and do the work that Fish and Game should have been doing had they had the manpower and been notified, maybe, of actually doing the survey and cataloging. So DNR is out there dropping fish traps and cricks and saying there's no fish. Lo and behold, a few years later, after the harvesting has occurred, there's fish in those cricks. Now, it's rather difficult to believe that all of a sudden fish runs were had become established there in those short periods of time after the department had assured us that there were no fish in a lot of these streams. We were categorically refused involvement in this process in both the Icy Cape 1 back in the late 60s, early 70s, as well as in Icy Cape 2. My personal involvement with a lot of these, some of these folks that were in charge, my requests for public involvement, my requests for meetings in Yakutat, sit down and talk to the people and tell them what was going to happen, what the scope of it was going to be, what the controls were going to be, what the management plans were going to be. And those were, as I say, categorically denied. Not necessarily we refused to come, it's just it never materialized. Nothing ever happened, despite our requests. Finally, we get up to a period of time, in the early 80s, when the Alaska Coastal Management Program came into being, and I guess we all kind of thought maybe that this was ushering in an era when there would be greater review, greater involvement in that process, so that we could begin to understand if things were being done properly, if management was being affected according to given laws, both within the department itself and also within the new ACMP process. That, to my knowledge and to my understanding, certainly has not occurred to the degree that it was supposed to. Maybe I'm a little bit out of line here in reiterating from some of the official memos and letters that have transpired back and forth, but I'd just like to quote here in a memo that was written in 89. It says, "In my assessment, the DOF defined processes for agency review and involvement are not consistent with DNR or ACMP statutes and do not allow an adequate opportunity for issue identification resolution prior to DNR decision making." Now, this wasn't in the cards.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you tell us what you're reading from?
I'm reading from a Fish and Game memo.
From who to who?
From Dave Hardy to Rick Reed.
Okay. Could you read it again? I'm sorry. I just...
Yeah. That way you put it in text. Yeah. I don't
okay.
Follow.
It just says that in my assessment, the DOF defined processes for agency review and involvement are not consistent with DNR or ACMP statutes and they do not allow an adequate opportunity for issue identification and resolution prior to DNR decision making. Now, certainly, I'm pulling this, you know, from Fish and Game's side of the picture, but I think we have to start somewhere in analyzing the piles of and reams of paper that have come out of this process since the late 60s. And now, with some period that I'm talking about, from the 80s on, this starts to make a little sense that somebody has to respond to these kinds of questions. And I guess I think that that's where some of the questions that maybe your committee should be asking. I'm certainly going to be asking the Division of Governmental Coordination and some of their ACMP people to review some of these. And I, you know, it may be that they need to be specifically reviewed, because I do not personally believe that the ACMP standards are being followed. Single agency reviews, I'd like to be proven wrong, and I'd like them to show me that I'm wrong. I don't believe that that is the case. In 1988, in the beginning of 1988, our frustrations with this whole process was getting to the point where when the department proposed the process of land of resource trades with the university to satisfy the court-mandated settlement, we, of course, had concerns with that, not only from having a meeting that we had had or two with university officials, and I have no problem with the university, and our community has none. We think it's a great institution and it has its place and it needs to be properly treated. However, officials from the university and the forestry management process, lands people, indicated that they thought that from both the department and Fish and Game's own admission here, that the previous harvester on Icy Cape 2 did a horrible job. I mean, there's no other way you can categorize it except he did a horrible bloody job. Their assessment was that he was a tremendous timber operator, and they were going to use him on their on this tracts that they were being given by the state in the process of this court-mandated settlement. Also, the university's and the department's refusal to even begin to listen to any of our concerns, particularly in terms of habitat. And, you know, Yakutat has been basically a community that has had a policy and supported multiple harvest, multiple resource use in our area. We've actually supported timber harvest where it was properly properly based, pay its own way, environmentally sound, some of those kinds of things. But we certainly don't condone a policy that doesn't give the proper considerations to habitat and fisheries and values that certainly are the mainstay of our community. At any rate, the lawsuit that was filed by the city of Yakutat, I guess, was in complete frustration that basically no one would listen to our concerns in regards to what was happening in that area. And we're quite frankly would be willing to settle that lawsuit on basically some of the criteria that I just mentioned to you, as long as a well-structured, you know, development policy could be put together for those lands. The one exception to that, of course, is the Suckling Hills area. And the very big problem with this Icy Bay logging process that the state is involved in is the fact that we're getting now out of areas that are probably the easiest in that whole area to log in terms of some separation between habitat values, even though we've had problems, we've had serious problems. We're now getting into areas up on the other side of Yakutaga. It's not included in this particular Icy Cape 2 extension, but it is proposed in the university tracts that have been already agreed to. And those are that we're now getting into areas that the values for fisheries and the values for timber are too intertwined to safely be able to harvest that area under the current process whereby DNR proposes to try to manage the harvesting activity. I guess what I'm saying is there need to be some change. There has to be some positive, definable, outward change in the policy that has taken place today in terms of management of those lands and the harvesting practices that they employed. 1987, November, we had a meeting in Yakutat basically to discuss a number of violations that had occurred as a result of Sullivan's operation in Icy Cape 2. We had pictures, we had a number of violations that, quite frankly, I was upset that they did not result in some kind of citation to somebody because they were serious enough to have been citable offenses. But that's been the history of this action up there. Nobody takes responsibility and nobody gets cited. Everybody goes home just happy. And that's a sad way to run the operation. At any rate, at that meeting in November, I know you're wanting...
Well, it just seems, Mr. Mayor, the testimony from the chair's standpoint, I don't think everybody went home happy.
Okay.
But
I respect that.
Yeah.
At any rate, if I might continue.
Please.
In 1987, when we got together in Yakutat to discuss these violations, the division, DOF, agreed and promised, not only myself, but all the people in Yakutat that were sitting at that meeting, that any further actions, any further disposals, any further land plans that were put together by the department because of the community of Yakutat's intense interest and dependence upon that area, that there would be definite, positive public hearings held in our community to give us an opportunity to respond to what was proposed. That never occurred. As a matter of fact, the latest hearing on this whole process of the Icy Cape 2 extension plus the classification process that has been ongoing, we requested a public hearing. And what we got was, quote, a public meeting. And I'm not quite sure precisely what the difference between a public hearing and a public meeting is, but I think there are definite differences. And I not only think that it was appropriate and should have been done by pure state policy, but I think that it also should have been done based upon the promises that were given to the people. I definitely don't agree with the state's, with the department's definition of sustained yield. The figures that they use are, quite frankly, not supportable. They're out of line and they're overinflated. They're using every single tree that lies between Icy Bay and Cape Suckling as a basis for sustained yield. Now, quite frankly, in areas where you have habitat retention for fisheries and for wildlife, which is, there are so many streams in that area that single space would almost take a full page here just to put them all down. You couldn't possibly harvest all of those trees and give deference to those habitat values. So how can you include them in a sustained yield process if you should never cut them to begin with? The rotation period that they use in their calculations are way off base. They're using 80 to 90 years or whatever it is. You can't grow a tree in that area in 80 or 90 years. It is not possible. It isn't even possible in the community of Yakutat itself. We're talking about more like 150 and 200 year rotations to achieve harvestable trees. Now, we've already harvested, you know, we're talking about sustained yield. That's forever and ever, huh? That's what that's supposed to mean. Every year we can harvest a certain amount of timber. But we've started in, you know, the early 70s. We're now all the way up to Yakutaga almost. The only area that's left is severely intertwined and braided habitat values in the Yakutaga drainage, the Kaliat, the Sayu drainage, and some of those drainages a little bit closer to the Cape Suckling, which is comprises that area known as the Suckling Hills. It just isn't possible. I don't know how else, you know, to tell you that. And I disagree with the department's regeneration figures. I've flown over that area numerous times at low altitude. It's not quite that easy to get out of the plane and walk up to the 400-foot elevation, quite frankly. But I have flown over at critical times of the year when the alder and that other superficial growth that they're talking about, you can't see the trees on the ground. Any trees that are there, you can see them well down about the 200-foot elevation. And there is fairly good restocking below that. But above that 200-foot level, there is very little restocking that is occurring. And this has been 20 years now since those areas were harvested in the immediate vicinity of Icy Bay. These are the areas that I'm talking about. In 20 years, you haven't got a tree that's up above the blueberry bushes so you can see it. My question is, I doubt if it's there. Now, we were assured in terms of goat habitat that these trees would grow back in a, you know, in a short period of time with only an 80-year harvest rotation. We'd have that goat habitat back in operation in a few years. Well, we haven't got any trees even showing above the blueberry bushes yet. This is 20 years down the road. I think that we're in serious jeopardy of breaching our obligation for reharvest, replanting, and making sure that it occurs. This department is obligated to do that. And I've not seen any more than vague statements that the trees are there. It's poor justification. Recently, and I'm just going to generalize this because you can get all of this paperwork as I've seen it, and no sense in my, you know, recapsulating everything. It's already in written reports by Fish and Game and other departments. But this most recent in Icy Cape 2, and all quite frankly on the other side of the White River into this Icy Cape 2 extension area, we had the present harvester, timber harvester there, authorized by the department to go in there and harvest timber in unclassified areas. Now, I'm not saying that maybe they didn't even know that they were classified, but God damn it, it's their job to know. They're supposed to know if it's not classified. The statement was made that maybe there's other lands that were originally in the area that would have satisfied that requirement of additional timber for the Icy Cape 2 extension. I agree with that. But
this meeting to order, and the purpose of tonight's meeting, if I can live through it here without